Thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. It's always a pleasure to be here at the law school, not just as a lecturer here for classes. Some time ago, I had thought about some of these general issues associated with what graduating students ought to be looking forward to in their first year. And then, as we all know, the economy continued to deteriorate, and it seems that in many respects, the issues that all of you who are third-year law students, or those of you who may be second years looking ahead to what may be facing you, have become that much more urgent in certain respects. Obviously, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, have heard about different things going on with law firms, not just in Washington, but around the country, with all kinds of responses to problems with the global economy. Hiring and pay freezes, delays in starting dates, sometimes up to a full year from the original starting date, significant pay cuts, not just for associates, and even rescission of offers by firms, and may I add, it's not just limited to the private sector, even prosecutors' offices have rescinded offers to third-year students. And of course, you have RIFs of various types, including attorneys as well as support staff, and so-called voluntary departure plans. The RIFs obviously have continued to mount over the last several months. Just not even in the first half of this month, we know that the numbers of attorneys who have been let go have far exceeded anything that was expected even toward the end of last year. In some cases where firms have said they need to terminate people, they have offered relatively generous severance packages, but in some cases that also involves having the associates or non-equity partners sign non-disclosure agreements and waivers of liability so the firms don't get sued after providing those benefits. Now, in response to all of that, you might be thinking, why are they doing this to me? Well, it really isn't personal. It is, unfortunately, a reflection of how dire, in some cases, the problems have become for private law firms and for a number of government agencies. The economics of law practice really are driving quite heavily some of these very tough decisions that firms and agencies are making around the country. One of the reasons in the private sector that some of these decisions are being made has to do very simply with the fact that law firms are being forced to make decisions about how they focus on more profitable work for those firms. Also, obviously, as you have economic retrenchments, you have the overall supply of work simply diminishing for firms all over the country. And, frankly, one of the concerns that partnerships have when they look at these kinds of issues is that the partners, particularly the ones who are the rainmakers, the ones who have the best access to and service to key clients, are going to be the people that firms want to hang on to the longest. So, again, firms are making hard choices based on, very simply put, who is going to provide the greatest support for the core business of the firm and who isn't. And in some cases, some of you may even have read about publicly, firms have acknowledged that their decisions on who to let go were simply premised on the fact that they decided they simply had an overcapacity in legal staff. Obviously, with different things that were happening even last year with the economy, some people might have been reluctant to try to find other work elsewhere, even if they sensed that they weren't going to make partner or might not have the best chances at their firms. And some firms have said, frankly, what we're trying to do, in effect, is recognize that there's only so much overcapacity that we're willing to tolerate. There are only so many people we're willing to keep carrying who aren't productive for us. So all of us, and you particularly in the third year, need to be focusing on the fact that there are some new realities to law practice, whether it's the public sector or the private sector. Whatever experiences you may have had last summer in working for firms or agencies, however great things were, that was last year, this is now. What I want to do as a result of all of these issues is to focus on, I think, three critical components of what I've characterized as, frankly, a survival strategy for all of you as you enter in your first year of law practice. The dominant thing I'll focus on today will focus on professional matters, although I do want to touch at least briefly on financial matters, though I'll add I am not a financial professional, and you're going to have, as I understand it, professional advice in the near future accessible to you here at the law school. But I think there's some things I can address briefly on financial issues that actually dovetail with part and parcel of this strategy. And finally, personal matters. You have to think in part about how you approach your first year, not just in terms of what's good for the employer, but what makes a difference for you. Now, some of you who have heard the very kind introduction have noticed that, you know, I had some experience in a private sector practice with a major firm quite some years ago. So some of you might be thinking, well, it's all very nice that he's here to talk to us, but what does he know about what's going on right now? Well, one of the advantages of being in the legal profession for some time is that between my college and law school classmates, other colleagues who have been in the government and have transited out, and others, I've actually been doing a lot of informal canvassing of partners at major firms, some of them the classic big law firms, some of them smaller, not just Washington, but also other cities like New York and the West Coast. And so what you're going to be hearing in part is not just my advice based on my own experience, but woven in throughout this is the advice that that's been passed on to me, typically on conditions of anonymity, by partners at a number of firms across the country. And all of this, I hope, will tie into something that will be a useful set of guidelines for you in approaching what to do in your first year of practice. Okay, let me address first and foremost professional matters. One of the things that you have to think about as a starting point to organize your thoughts on this is to set up what you might think of as a timeline for how to address all these different issues. And I think there are three main parts of the timeline that enter into this discussion. First, whatever happens between commencement and the bar exam, the time you finish the bar exam to your actual starting date at wherever you're going to be working, and whenever you start to roughly 1 year out from that time. At some point, I'll also briefly address what you want to be thinking about once you get past that one-year date, but it's those first three parts of the timeline that I'm going to spend the bulk of my time on. The first bit of advice I want to offer you, and I'm trying to stay away from the usual commencement-style platitudes as you enter into this noble profession and focus very much on practicalities. So let's be practical. At time of commencement, it's okay to enjoy commencement. Really, you can do it. I know lots of you must have worries of varying degrees, but focus on this as being a situation where you're really not going to be able to affect outside events in any event. So finish the semester, enjoy commencement to the full, and yes, the bar exam is out there. You can set aside those worries a little bit. At some point after commencement, obviously, you do have to think about the bar exam. And so let me offer a couple of key points in how you approach the whole process of going at the bar exam. The critical thing to think about here is all the issues about GPAs, class rank, etc., are out the window. The only thing you have to do is pass. Nobody's going to give you a special pat on the head if you get the top 1% of all scores on the bar exam, or if you try to be like Justice Cardozo long ago and get the highest score ever recorded in the history of the state bar. You only have to pass. So how do you get to that point of passing? Take one of the well-established bar courses in whatever jurisdiction you're going to be taking the exam in. The bar courses, year in, year out, will give you what you need to know. It's going to be spoon-fed to you, or maybe in some respects force-fed to you in a way that's going to be totally different from law school, although some of the faces you see in those review courses may be familiar to you from this faculty or other law faculties. The second thing you want to think about with respect to approaching the bar exam, of course, it's a very draining sort of experience in certain respects. It's very demanding, but all you have to do is remember this material as it is spoon-fed or force-fed to you through the bar review process up through the date of the exam. Now, let me be precise about saying this. Of course, it's important that you know the substantive law of the jurisdiction in which you're practicing, but in almost 30 years, I have to say, I cannot remember a single substantive point that was force-fed to me during a bar review course that ever came handy in the practice of law. But in terms of knowing issues in a broad sense. You know, what to look for if you have to look up an issue with respect to the law of agency or contracts or something else. The main thing that does to you is remind you that, yes, there must be some law here somewhere in the D.C. Code or a Virginia Code or whatever. As a result, what you want to be thinking about here is making sure you remember the stuff as it's given to you, using the test-taking techniques that you're given. But think about this as a situation where the whole process is designed simply to allow you to use what some lawyers refer to as bathtub memory. In other words, you stuff your head full of this stuff, you take the exam, and when you're done, you pull the plug, and it all drains out. Nothing that you have to remember up through the second day of the bar exam, as I've suggested, is going to do any practical good in practice. So all you have to do is make sure that you remember it and give it back to the bar examiners that they want it to be given to them. And when you're done, and you can set the bar exam and the whole process aside. So, second phase. Bar exam to starting date for wherever you're going to be going to work. First important thing, take some time off after the exam. I don't care how conscientious you are. I don't care if your employer is willing to take you 1 week after the bar exam. One, you've earned the right to take a little bit of time off after the bar exam. And two, you'll need at least a little bit of time for decompression, relaxing, and just getting in a frame of mind where you're again ready to sort of go into the business of the practice of law. But, and I want to stress this particularly for those of you who, for example, may have delayed starting dates, who may be looking, I know in some cases, at late November of this year or even beyond that. While it'd be tempting to say, hey, I'm going to spend lots of time on the beach and relax and then I'll show up on day one, I do want to suggest that you want to pursue in the interim, while you're getting ready to start wherever you're going to be working, pursue an interim strategy that will help you continue your process of professional preparation and growth. And here are three particular things I want to focus on. Professional development, and yes, there are some things you can do even before you start work, even before you're admitted to the bar. Second, business intelligence. And third, also important given the current economic environment, contingency planning. Let me start by talking first about professional development. Particularly if you've got an extended period before you're going to start work, I recommend that if at all possible, you try to do something law-related while you're waiting to start. I'm not saying you have to go find another totally different job from the one that you're lined up for, but trying to do something, whether it's pro bono work or some kind of writing, law review article, practical article for a bar journal, anything like that, I think is worth seriously considering. Particularly pro bono work, I can suggest a couple of reasons you want to think about that. First of all, of course, it's going to be good for you professionally and you're doing good for somebody else. It also means, and this is an important point, while you're looking at what may be a fairly extended period before you can actually start with your employer, you are continuing to hone your skill sets. You have an opportunity potentially while you're working in some pro bono capacity to do things like brief drafting or work in litigation situations where you've got some opportunity to continue to carry through on the skills you've been mastering here at the law school. And you're also having the opportunity to develop skills that may be directly useful. When you walk in on day one and say, oh, you know, you asked me what I've been doing, here's what I've been doing. Now, if you do want to pursue something like this, and you find, let's say, a potential opportunity for pro bono work of some kind, whether it's, you know, in the place where you live or even some other location, I think it's a good idea that you at least check in with your prospective employer before you actually agree to take on some other project. There are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, the maybe unlikely but still possible scenario is you go to work, let's say, for some human rights organization, and you start to get involved in working even before you're admitted to the bar on some matter. And then you find out that that matter is one on which your firm is going to be representing somebody on the other side of that litigation. Not a comfortable place to be in if that's where you end up. As a practical matter also, if you went to your prospective employer and said, look, you know, I'd really like to do something with myself, you know, in a legal capacity, even if I can't start here yet, and I'm thinking about pro bono work, the firm itself may say, hey, actually, we've got some opportunities that we could steer you to. You know, we have regular relationships with this or that organization, and, you know, as long as there's an understanding that you're not working for us yet, but you're working in this pro bono capacity, you know, maybe we can match you up with a particular location where you could do this kind of work. One thing I'll also say, though, is that certainly this is true with some of the larger firms that have done layoffs. In some instances, some of the big law firms have, as part of their effort to ease the fall for associates who are being laid off, are actually placing those laid off associates with public interest organizations and even providing some kind of a stipend, although it may be far below their previous salary with the firm, which might provide a little bit of constraint as to what kind of response you get if you go to your prospective employer. The key thing I want to stress here, and again, this is particularly with those of you who are going to be looking at a potentially extended period before you start work. Don't assume if you sit back on your heels for 6 or 8 months or more that you're necessarily going to be viewed as attractive as other first years when you walk in the door eventually at that firm. If you do nothing of a professional nature and just say, well, spent lots of time on the beach and I hiked and I saw Chichen Itza and lots of other fabulous places, and other people come in the door and say, well, yeah, and I also worked for this organization, that organization, and I drafted this brief that was going to the Fifth Circuit and so on. It may be a subtle point, but it will be something that might not be lost on partners at your new employer if they look at you and say, well, gee, that person showed some real initiative in doing something even before he or she showed up, and this person, not so much. There is particularly, I think, a risk that the longer you're away from your firm and the less you do that might have some professional bearing, that old adage, out of sight, out of mind, may tend to work more and more on how you're perceived once you get to that firm. Now, I want to focus on the concept of business intelligence. What do I mean by business intelligence? Well, as you heard in my introduction, before I came down here to the university, I did work as an intelligence analyst. And that experience, in some respects, has stuck with me throughout my professional career. One of the things you'll recognize once you start working and having experience with clients is that particularly larger firms, but even moderate-sized firms who are clients of your particular law practice, have in one way or another some kind of a unit, could be one person, it could be a raft of people around the world, who gather intelligence, information relevant to that particular business or organization, that helps the business organization make decisions about what it's going to do strategically and tactically. As a practical matter, more and more of what I see in law practice around the country, and I think in other countries as well, reflects the fact that even if you think of your practice as being relatively local, the reality is that events all over the country and beyond our borders affect the availability of opportunities for work, affect the ability of law firms to continue to sustain business. So law firms' perspective increasingly has to be global. Where can we find new clients? How do we retain the clients we have? How do we put ourselves out there so that even in this tough environment, we can continue to be thriving and successful? So what you have to think about here is that what affects other businesses or employers here and abroad also affects your prospective employer, wherever it happens to be located. So in one very real sense, you have to think of yourself as being a one-person intelligence unit. What do I mean by that? It means you need to be thinking, before you get to the firm, about starting together intelligence about two categories of information. First, your employer. The reality of what you've seen, particularly in recent months, is that law firms are likely to play their cards very, very close to the vest until the last possible minute before they say, okay, here's our plan for dealing with retrenchment. You know, we're going to A, reduce salaries, B, lay off support staff, C, do any number of other things. And they're not going to be revealing those kinds of thought processes well in advance. But you can pick up clues from various sources about what's happening with your firm. Just because you have an offer in hand that said, yes, yes, you can definitely start as of November 30th or whatever, doesn't mean that things may not continue to happen that affect your employer. So you need to be thinking about how you can gather information in an appropriate way about your employer and gather intelligence about continuing trends in the legal profession in general and how the economy may be affecting that. How do you do that? Well, you need to think about being proactive in gathering that kind of intelligence. Can you rely basically just on calling up the partner that you had such a good relationship with last summer, the hiring partner, or whoever your primary point of contact is with your firm? Yes, if you do it once in a while. Don't expect you're going to have the opportunity to talk to that person every week and say, so, how's it going now? Any problems yet? You know, they're not going to give you that kind of information, and you can't expect that of them. So you can't rely primarily on in-house contacts for that kind of information. What can you do? Well, there are a couple of tools readily available online that can at least start you down the road of gathering information in a proactive way. One of the simplest tools I can think of is using Google Alerts. I don't know if any of you have used Google Alerts for other things, but Google Alerts basically allows you to take a particular search term. You know, in my work, I do things like internet fraud, Ponzi schemes, et cetera, to gather wherever Google picks up the stuff from all over the web and look for it on a regular basis. Think about how you can turn that to your advantage if you take your firm's name and plug that in, and then let Google do the work of crawling the web, finding new reports. They could be really good reports about some major case where a partner has just won a fabulous verdict. It could be some other issue associated with the firm, or you know, adverse things that are happening to the firm's practice or to a client that you know is a prime client of the firm. And the advantage of Google Alerts is you can even set the delivery frequency. You know, you can get it as it happens, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend. You don't want to have a constant stream of stuff every single day, 24/7. Or you can have it like every day or every week. But it gives you an opportunity without having to bother anybody at your firm or employer to get additional information on a continuing streaming basis to you. There's also a variety of legal blogs and sites that some of you may already have seen. Some of these are sort of standard stuff that even lower level to mid-level associates are regularly screening, like Above the Law. The Wall Street Journal has a pretty good law blog that I have here. Law.com, which is a very nice site that streams in from multiple major legal newspapers like National Law Journal, Legal Times, and so on, is a nice one-stop shop. There, too, you can also take advantage of their streaming capacities to get a regular newswire of relevant stuff that comes from their site. And there are other blogs and commentaries like Overlawyered and The Shark that, if you haven't already started to look at them, I expect that you and a number of your first-year associates will be regularly consulting as the year wears on. And there are a couple of other business publications that may be particularly helpful for this kind of stuff. I've just put down a couple here, such as the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, the latter one particularly including information that's directly relevant to careers. And while they may not be covering law issues every day, it may be part and parcel of the larger information gathering you want to be thinking about doing. Now, contingency planning. Unfortunately, because of the current trends that you're all too familiar with, you do have to think about making some plans, even if they're tentative plans, in case something goes wrong with your job. That something goes wrong could be relatively modest, like, gee, we've had to push your start date back by another 6 months, or worst case scenario, I'm really, really sorry, we're in a very difficult position right now, you know, we wish you all the best, etc., etc. What kind of planning do you do in case of that kind of potentially disastrous situation? Well, as a general matter, it's certainly accurate that litigation by associates against their firms is, in fact, reportedly on the rise for a variety of under a variety of causes of action. Nonetheless, I have to say, as a general strategy, that suing your prospective employer is probably not the best way to go starting out in the legal profession. What I think you are entitled to do at a minimum is to negotiate with that employer whatever the best deal is that you can get. That may include some kinds of payments. You know, if you haven't started with a firm, that won't include severance, but there may be other things that, given the fact that you have some reliance interest that you can express to partners at the firm, I think they have some degree of responsibility in saying, okay, I know we've made this difficult decision and it's terrible for you. We're prepared to do these things, and you may only be able to do the best you can do in trying to get some more favorable terms. you do want, in any event, even if things look like they're chugging along very nicely and you're not hearing anything adverse about what's going on, you still want to keep your eyes and ears open for any alternatives for legal employment that you think you might be qualified for. And in this environment, I have to say, you want to be a little bit flexible about what those possibilities may be. It may be that even if you pick City A as your primary focus and where you have your heart set on practicing, that the opportunities are going to open up in a city different from that one. It may also be that private and public sectors both have to be looked at fairly broadly, including the government as one of the areas of practice. One thing that I heard from a partner at a firm that actually is in very good shape right now, but has had an opportunity to observe a lot of these trends, his advice, very frankly, was find a job. He said, even if it may not be what you had hoped or expected, get in somewhere. I think that speaks to the point that it's more important to get yourself started in practice rather than waiting and hoping to find the perfect situation in the perfect place. Now, assuming you've gotten through that difficult period and you finally are on the threshold, you're on the doorstep of your new employer on your very first day, what do you say and what do you do on day one? Keeping in mind that this is a vastly different economic environment from what that firm was looking at a year or 2 years before. I'm not saying this is the way the firm will be looking at you, but I think you should, as a practical matter, make three assumptions that will guide your thinking about what to do on that first critical day and the initial days thereafter. First of all, assume that everybody at that firm knows more and counts for more than you do. That's a very hard lesson for people who are coming in, the best and the brightest from law schools all over this country, who have high degrees of confidence in how well they can do in practice. You still have to recognize that you are the new kid on the block, and especially because everybody at that firm, from the managing partner all the way down to the most junior support staff, has seen through and survived everything that's been thrown at that firm so far. So the fact that you come in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed may be a great thing, but you have to assume that there's a lot you don't know about what's been going on inside that firm, what kinds of stresses they've had to deal with, what kinds of difficult decisions they've made where friends may be parting with friends as a result of rifts, or other things that adversely affect people at the firm. The manner and attitude I think you want to convey, and maybe it's going to be especially likely if you've had to wait a little bit longer before getting on their doorstep, you are happy to be there. It may be that you're feeling that inside, but you want to convey in your manner that you are happy to be there. Literally, on the way down here to the law school, I was chatting by phone with one of my college classmates who's now a senior partner with a major firm out on the West Coast, and he said, you would be surprised how many associates at my firm act like their job is an imposition. You don't want to give people the wrong impression, even if you're working very, very hard and what you're working on may not be the preferred thing you're doing at that moment. You do not want to convey the impression that you're dissatisfied with what life has thrown you. At least at the outset, you want to be very clear in what you convey in your attitude, that you're happy to be there, you're ready to start work, and you're pretty much ready to take whatever gets thrown at you in the process of helping this firm along with its practice. If you haven't done this already from a previous stint as a summer associate at that firm, make it a point from day one to learn and to use everybody's name. Again, from the managing partner all the way down to the lowest level support staff person. People actually like to be addressed in a polite way, in an engaging way. And particularly when you're the new person on the scene, it's all the more important that you convey that degree of genuine interest and genuine appreciation for the fact that they're there and can help you particularly learn your ropes, learn the ropes as you get into the practice there. Second assumption. Again, a hard thing to hear, but it is strongly premised on the kinds of comments I've heard from partners. Everyone else, at least among attorneys, is worth more than you on day one. Doesn't matter how extremely hard you've worked, how brilliant you are, how great you are in law school classes, your perceived marginal value to the partnership on day one is greater than zero, but not a whole lot. And that in part is a reflection of the way clients look at the firm and its billing. Many clients, I understand from talking to some of my friends who are partners, take the attitude that they don't particularly like having to pay bills that include billing for first-year associates because their assumption is first years know nothing. And we're basically paying for these first years to learn their jobs. Third critical assumption. Knowing that that perceived marginal value is only going to be a little bit above zero at the very beginning, you need to increase your marginal value as soon as possible to that firm. And in saying that, I'm knowledgeable of the fact that you need to assume that economic conditions throughout this economy and beyond the borders of this country are continuing to be volatile both this year and into next year. So, how do you go about that process of increasing your marginal value? First of all, recognize the role that you play as a first year. Your role, as one Washington, D.C. partner said to me recently, is you are there as a first year to support partners. You know, you think you may be ready to start giving advice and participating fully in discussions, but the partners are the ones who have the prior relationship with the client. The partners are the ones who have set the terms on which they are going to be providing legal services to those clients. And so, in order to support partners effectively, you need to do a couple of things. First of all, you want to make sure you know what your supervisor, whether it's a senior partner, mid-level partner, senior associate, what your supervisor wants, and check in as regularly as need be as you're making progress on whatever your assignment is. Second critical point, consistent with the idea of supporting partners, in a client meeting, even if you're there with the open invitation of a partner or other supervisor, do not offer advice on your own or answer questions that the clients pose unless the partner invites you to do so. Why? Going back to the first point, the partner is the one who has set the terms on which the representation is going forward. The partner is the one who ultimately has the decisions to make about how to do things. And so while your behind-the-scenes advice, questions, and recommendations may be welcomed, you need always to take the partner's lead and not put yourself forward unless it's with the understanding that the partner wants to hear from you. Another critical point about how you increase your margin of value early on. You should be prepared, maybe even more so than usual in the current environment, to be flexible in what kinds of work assignments you take on in your first year. Especially given this current situation where there's all these different types of volatility that you're all too familiar with, partners will tend to remember who is willing to step up when there is something really difficult, perhaps even challenging, nasty, you know, hard to get your hands around, hard to fix, and who wasn't willing to step up for those difficult assignments. As a practical matter, since we're focusing just on your first year of practice, being willing to be flexible in the kind of work assignments you take on actually can work to your advantage. Unless you know with absolute certainty that you're just going to focus on doing criminal antitrust or international transactions or one specific area already, and that's what you're devoted to heart and soul, broader exposure to more kinds of legal issues that the firm is picking up as part of its practice can help you sort out, very simply, what kind of a lawyer you want to be. If it's possible, even though you may have originally taken the offer with the assumption that you're going to be working primarily or exclusively for one department, watch as you move into that area. If you have to be in a very specific department or practice area, see if there are opportunities where you can, at least in subtle ways, avoid getting totally locked into that firm's practice 52 weeks a year. Unless, of course, it's a very stable or growing practice that you're confident is not going to have the kind of significant dislocations a lot of firm practices have had. Another point suggested to me by a different Washington, D.C. partner with a major international firm. And in terms of how to increase your marginal value to the firm, think about it the way you thought about college, picking a major and picking a minor. In this case, you're thinking about picking one major area that you want to start developing some specialized expertise in, and maybe a minor area. The idea being, It's always great if you can be seen by people as you start work at the firm about being the go-to person on an issue. But if you can develop, ideally, two specific areas, one of them might be relatively narrow, one of them might be broader. If you've got at least two areas where you can start developing that kind of specialized expertise, it will allow you to be seen by others at the firm as being a go-to person in each of those areas. Inevitably, as associates, especially with bigger firms, you're likely to get thrown a lot of different work early on, and it may be overwhelming at times. There are times when you can legitimately say, it's more than you can humanly stand, it is okay, simply as a matter of professionalism, to push back, but to do so in a professional way and saying, okay, I've only slept 5 hours, the last 3 weeks running. I really, really just need to let you know that I've got competing demands from this partner in this practice area and that partner in that practice area. I want to do a really good job here, but I'm getting really conflicting demands here. Sometimes, and maybe it's a good thing in certain respects, you can be in too much demand in the firm, but you have to be prepared, if it comes to that, to say, you need to sort this out, and I want to be responsible to everybody, and I can't make this decision. Can you refuse assignments that you really absolutely hate? Even in this environment, I'll say maybe, but I think it can't be a matter of whim or perceived as whim on the part of the supervisors who are overseeing your work. It can't be, I don't know if I really want to do that stuff on corporate finance. It's not really my thing. If there's, on the other hand, a really personal reason that you have for refusing a particular assignment, that I think is okay. But in the first year of practice, given the volatility of law practice that you're seeing right now in a lot of firms, assume that you're only going to get one bite at that apple in the first year. So if you have to offer up a refusal, make sure it's for a really good reason. Another point that you want to be thinking about, and this is you in part looking at where you want your career to be going. You need to be thinking about the concept of branding. This isn't something I've just dragged across the courtyard from the B school. This is something that increasingly affects law firms' own practices every single day. Just as law firms, in other words, are focusing more and more on the concept of branding the firm, you need to think about branding yourself. As one psychologist, Dr. Judith Sills, put it in a really interesting Psychology Today article that I've got a link for up here, she has said, you need to think of this as you being your own brand. In other terms, she's talking about the professional identity that you create in the minds of others, both your employer and others, prospective or actual clients, who are going to be dealing with you. How do you improve your branding, even as a first-year associate? One of the first things you can do is talking about that major and minor concept, establishing a niche expertise, something that somebody else at the firm isn't offering right now, or that maybe you have to step into the breach to handle because the firm needs that kind of expertise in this very narrow area right now. Another thing that branding is associated with is, as Dr. Sills has said, sending clear signals about your key attributes. This has nothing to do with substance. This has everything to do with how your employer is reading you in terms of how consistent are you in your work. Are you reliable? Can you deliver projects on time? Often a very critical issue for firms that are running high-profile, very demanding practices. To help you along with your branding process, establishing your professional identity, a lot of employers will be willing to help you with that. You can look for opportunities, in other words, that your employer may be willing to steer you toward. When I started out in practice, I was lucky enough to have work with one partner who actively encouraged me, in addition to the substantive legal knowledge I was developing, to start out doing bar association talks, writing on that subject. And while you may be the co-author, the second author on the masthead for that particular article or chapter in a book, the fact remains that you're getting your name out there and having it associated with concrete, specific contributions to the practice. As Dr. Sills has said in a different context, you have to show what you know. And the more that you have the opportunity to show others, to show supervisors at your firm, senior partners, others, that you have this knowledge, that you do speak about it publicly and write about it publicly, that helps to f- firm up the brand that you're creating for yourself in your profession. However, you also want to be thinking about what you can do beyond just developing expertise in terms of how you brand yourself, what kind of professional identity you create. And one of the things that a different partner at a major Washington law firm recommended was, don't be shy about walking in a partner's or supervisor's door, you know, assuming you've already gotten a little bit of work under your belt and people are starting to see you do good work. There is nothing at all wrong with taking the initiative and walking into somebody and saying, gee, I know you do work in this particular area. If you have the opportunity, I'd really love to get involved in something there. You know, I'm currently doing this for partner A and that for partner B, but if the opportunity presents itself, you know, I'd appreciate it if you could keep me in mind. You want to work, in other words, at forming relationships at the firm. Don't rely on the fact that the partner is going to come to you and say, I need this memo, I need it by tomorrow noon, and that's your relationship defined in terms of delivering a product. You want to be trying to develop relationships as opportunities present themselves at your employer. For example, invite a partner to lunch. It may be perfectly fine at that firm for partners to get, you know, an invitation from a junior associate. Just say, trying to learn the ropes, I'm trying to learn more here. Would you be willing to sit in and, you know, just chat for a while? Or drop by visits. Anything that helps you proactively to establish these kinds of relationships. Also, one of the first-year associates at a New York law firm whom I taught last year had said, the advantage of your getting to know people at the firm, taking the initiative, is they can speak to the value added that you provide at that firm. So it's not just about pumping out work. It's about making sure in discreet ways that people know that you're doing work in this area, that you're taking an interest in the practice, taking an interest in the people in the practice. As a different partner said in an email I got, many associates get work and good work by taking the initiative and showing interest. Don't wait for opportunities. Make them. So, in line with that, another suggestion that the same partner who talked about majors and minors for substantive work suggested was think about, consistent with what your firm's practice is on having a mentor, if they have a formal mentoring program, you may want to think about not something you announce to the world, but a major and a minor mentor. And the point that he added is, don't think about doing it in the same two substantive areas of law that you're trying to develop a major and minor in for the firm. Pick two people in different practice areas. The idea, again, is to get exposed to more people in that firm, have more of a base on which people get to know you, even if today you're not doing work for them. You're at least coming to them for advice, suggestions, counseling, in addition to the substantive contributions you're making. Clearly, the more senior the partner, everything else being equal, the more clout that person is likely to have in future discussions, including, you know, those difficult decisions about who they let go and who they keep. By the same token, the more senior the partner, the busier the partner, the harder it is to get any face time with that person. So you do the best you can do in terms of trying to make those additional contacts with prospective mentors at the firm. If you establish that kind of relationship, whether it's formally or informally within the firm, make sure you listen carefully to what the mentors are telling you. Of course, you can make your own decision ultimately that may not go the direction that the mentor has suggested, but if a mentor says to you, gee, you know, I really think you might want to take a crack at this practice area. We could use some good help here. They're not just saying that out of the general goodness of their hearts. They may be thinking, you know, this person has skill sets that would match up well in an area where we need help. And if you think about it, maybe that practice area isn't the one you've set your heart on since law school days, but it may, consistent with what I said before about being flexible in assignments, it may be something that the law firm will be more appreciative of if you tackle that assignment and move into that practice area than if you say, no, I don't care what you say, I'm standing pat and working on this project, working in this practice area. The other thing I think it's important to point out with respect to branding, having said all these things that you can do to try to improve your visibility, show the firm your own skill sets, try to get your name out there, don't leave it all to your employer. Again, the realities in some firms may be that they're continuing to make hard decisions about who they keep, who they let go, whose salaries they reduce, whose they don't. And one of the quotes that I saw in Dr. Sills' article that was written well before all this stuff went on with the world economy still applies in this context. As she wrote, "For a successful long-term career, do not look to your company or industry to take care of you. As in every other arena of life, you must take care of yourself." And one of the ways you do that is making sure, consistent with the things I've been saying, to try to look for topics or specialties at the firm that appeal to you. It's perfectly fine to start trying, even in your first year, to identify areas you think might be really worthwhile, really rewarding on a longer-term basis. And if you've got an interest in a particular area, even if it's a relatively niche practice, and even if it's not the firm that's setting up these opportunities for you, there's always a market for good communicators in the legal world. I know from my own experience, I've written for any number of bar publications, other legal publications, law reviews, etc. Publishers and associations that need speakers are always desperate for people who can speak concisely, knowledgeably, and well about particular topics. So there are opportunities you may be able to make for yourself, even if your employer doesn't do it for you. And as a practical matter, you might find something else in the course of doing this kind of work that makes you decide, you know, I'd really like to be doing that rather than what I'm doing or expected to be doing over the next year or more. It may help, in other words, in redirecting your professional energies and interests in a direction where you're confident that's where you want to go. Just as grade school teachers used to say decades ago to you, neatness counts, well, neatness still counts, especially in your first year of practice. The first admonition, and it seems like it's an obvious thing to say, but it needs to be said, and I think all of you need to take it to heart because you'll find probably associates in your same class who won't take it to heart. You need to do and to turn in high-quality work on time. That's a specific admonition from one of the partners I talked to. Partners have said to me more than once, I can't believe some of the stuff I'm getting, even for people who come out of the best law schools. You know, basic things, failing to catch typos, failing to do full site checks, all kinds of basic things that people should know how to do by now are not getting done. So, having a very high quality work product matters more than ever. Consistent with what I said before about the problems associated with trying to juggle multiple responsibilities, if you see that you may have to miss a deadline on some project, that may be fine, but you need to talk to your supervisor about it in advance. Don't let it slide and come back to that supervisor 2 or 3 days later saying, oh, I didn't get that portion of the brief done, or I didn't get that memo done. That's a bad position to put yourself in, particularly because, as one partner said, if in your first year you have a bad experience with a partner on your first assignment, you may not get back to that partner to try to remedy the impression and do a better job for some time to come. And all that time, that partner has that memory of you and your work festering in his or her mind. It's important, obviously, if you do have multiple assignments, to stay organized, particularly when you've got multiple projects from multiple supervisors with multiple deadlines. One of the perhaps cheesy little acronyms that you want to think about, if you haven't seen other how-to guides in how to organize your work and organize your material, if you are floundering in a sea of emails and paper, use a RAFT. And the RAFT stands for 4 steps that allow you to process emails, phone calls, drop-by visits, paper. Read, at least if anything that's readable, take action on it, whatever it is, file it, throw it away. There are only 4 things you need to do. Lots of people you'll come across probably in your first year, maybe even people you've seen if you've been a summer associate at various employers, will be pack rats. They'll have, you know, yards and yards of paper that are piled up, and their desks look terrible, and everything's terribly disorganized. You need to stay on top of your work, and you need to use some basic organizing principles to keep things organized. Here, I've just cited a few of the online productivity resources that I think provide some really good advice for different contexts, how you can organize information of any type, how you organize workflows, and so on. It's not just you personally in what you turn out. It's even how your office looks to people. When you think about it this way, your office in your employer is an extension of your brand. That is your professional identity. And you have to be thinking in part about how you want to be perceived by your supervisors, and by other people, your peers, at your employer. I'm now going to show you two photos. These are both of people, not naming the first of them, in my section of the Department of Justice. I am not joking. That is the way this person's office looks, week in, week out, year in, year out. And don't think his reputation doesn't coincide with how people look at how he organizes himself. Second photo, it's mine. But, you know, I use that cheesy little RAFT acronym. Everything that's organized here, and let me add, yes, my office looks right now the way it did in this photograph from several months ago. There's one place where everything is for inbox. Everything gets processed there. One larger pile for filing, one pile for reading. If you're working on something, you're working on it one item at a time, and you organize your workspace in a way that makes it easy for you to get to your phone, your computer, materials, etc. Don't forget networking. And I'm not talking just about internal networking at your employer. Although, as I've been talking about, developing good relationships with colleagues is very important in your first year of practice. But you want to be thinking about networking even beyond your employer. Again, the partner that I was talking to on the way down here said, and this is pretty close to direct quote, stay in touch with and maintain really good relationships with everybody you know. Your college classmates, your law school classmates, your associates, family, friends of the family, everybody that you might have some contact with, because, as he put it, you never know where your first referral of a client is going to come from. Time and again, I know from dealing with friends and colleagues who are in Washington law practices, that lots of times a client may come in and say, I really want you to represent me. I know you're the best at whatever this particular specialty is. Firms get a conflict. Well, they obviously want to refer that prospective client to somebody else, if it's, one, a paying client, and two, a client who may have, you know, a continuing source of business for some other person. So where does that referral come to? You need to think about those things, even in the early stages of your law practice, in order to figure out, how's business going to come to me? How do I continue to add value to a firm? Looking even beyond your employer, or looking beyond your circle of acquaintances, you really want to think about, even though it may be some expense to you, more than it used to be because firms don't pay as much, if at all, for bar association memberships, you still want to think at an early stage about developing formal relationships through bar associations in your area. That could be for a specialty area of practice that you're interested in, or if you're just generally interested in trying to do something to improve the legal system in one way or another. And that may include both the individual state or local bars that you have and larger bar associations, whether it's the major ones like the American Bar Association or state or local bars or other kinds of special affinity bars. Anything that helps you to expand your circle of acquaintances and get broader exposure to key issues, key areas of interest, will work to your advantage in the long term. Now, let me address a specific thing, and this is kind of like having the fire extinguisher on the wall in the law school or at home. You need, before you get started in practice, to plan what to do when you make a mistake. And the chances are, even in your first year, you may make a mistake. There are several steps you want to think through in advance before the mistake. Well, how can I avoid making a mistake? Well, one of the things you want to do is, as one of my friends put it, you know, be guided by associate paranoia. Like, there's nothing you can't do to keep reproofing that brief for the umpteenth time, checking for every possible flaw, no matter how slight. But you don't want to be mastered by paranoia and just be frantic about it to the point where you're not effective any longer. You want to obviously take as much effort as possible to minimize the chance that you're going to make a mistake, and in taking on whatever your supervisor has given you to do, make sure you get clear instructions from your supervisor on what you need to do. What's the limit of your authority, in other words, to act? If you find yourself in a situation where you realize that you've got some kind of responsibility for a mistake, maybe it's that that brief has already gone off to the printers, it's going to be going up to the Supreme Court, and you realize there's some glaring typo that you missed on the cover page, Number one, you need to take some responsibility for that, but don't exceed your supervisor's instructions. In other words, if you are responsible for sending that particular brief to the printer, don't you assume that you should get on the phone and start talking to the printer. Talk to the person who needs to handle that responsibility and say, there's a mistake, we need to fix it, and handle it that way. Second thing, with any kind of mistake, never lie. People get worried, people get frantic. It's a strong temptation to lie, fudge the truth just a little bit about what you did. Never lie. I'm telling you seriously, you have to think about this in advance, because when that moment comes, the temptations to do something that gets the pressure away from you will be very, very strong. And you've just got to say, I've got to tell the truth here. I know it's going to hurt me, but I'm better off telling the truth right now than letting a lie fester. And the other thing is, consistent with all these other things, you also want to protect the client's interests. You can't do something that, even if you otherwise think it might be the right thing for the firm, if there's any way that it might be disadvantageous to the client's interest, you can't do it, and you need to talk to your supervisor about what's to be done to avoid any kind of adverse effect on the client's interest. Once you know the mistake has happened, you've got to promptly admit what happened, talk to your supervisor, and then do whatever he or she tells you to do to fix the problem. Consistent with, again, not going beyond the scope of your authority. Do what you're told to do to fix that problem, and with luck, that may just be a minor bump in the road in an otherwise sterling career for you. Now, that last category of timeline, 1 to 5 years out. I'm not purporting to give you advice about where you want to be thinking in 5 years' time, but your first year really can be an excellent opportunity to think through where you want to be in 5 years. If you can spot one or two practice areas, for example, that make you feel like, gee, I'd really like to do this. I didn't have exposure to it in law school, or I've just gotten into this, but you know, I really think I have some, you know, something to contribute here. You really want to think about, is this something I could continue to pursue? Is this something that the firm is willing to let me build up? Is this a niche practice that I could start developing for myself as part of the process of adding value to the firm? In a very basic sense, even in your first year, you are building a career. And in some respects, two little pictures that I have here offer you two different views of how a career can develop. First picture, you may have seen if you've been in and around this area, Keswick Hall. You know, if you sort of visualize metaphorically what you want your practice to look like, that's the way you want the practice to look. It's elegant, it's sophisticated, everything is first rate, looks fabulous. A lot of people who have legal careers unfortunately end up with something that's more like the Winchester House. I don't know if any of you have ever been in the Winchester House. It's out in San Jose, California. The Winchester House is famous now mostly as a tourist attraction because it was built and built and built over a period of more than 30 years by a widow who inherited vast sums of money from the Winchester firearms largesse. And for whatever reasons, she chose to build lots and lots of wings in her house, even when they led to nowhere. Literally, there are staircases that lead up to the ceiling and go nowhere. There are windows that open on nothing, doors that open to nothing. Unfortunately, I've seen a couple people, including from my law school class or near law school class, who ended up with careers like that. They had a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They dabbled and dabbled and dabbled and never tried to develop anything that was a real practice area of focus for them, and they ended up with a lot of stairs that led to nowhere, blind alleys, things that left them 10, 20 years out of practice as having really nothing to point to as an area where they were making a significant contribution. So, given the time, I'm just going to quickly highlight a couple things here. You're certainly free, and I'll add, for those of you who may have been writing at one point or another here, we can provide copies of this PowerPoint to anybody by email if you provide the names to whoever is here. So I just want to highlight a couple things very quickly in the interest of time. Think of this as kind of the J-term course in financial affairs. A basic rule of thumb that I've actually talked to about with a former dean of this another law school than this one, don't spend up to your salary. After years of law school penury, you may be thinking, woohoo, $160,000 in New York, or wherever you happen to be. You can't assume that even if you make $60,000, you're actually making $160,000. What you're left with after you back out all of the obvious costs, fixed and variable costs, you don't have as much leftover as you think. And particularly in this economic environment, you need to be thinking about controlling your costs, both fixed and variable costs. Fixed costs, how do you control fixed costs? They're fixed, aren't they? Well, with rent, you may want to have a little bit more of a financial cushion than you've had previously in mind. You know, maybe you don't take the apartment that's, you know, X amount per month. You may want to dial it back a little bit, leave yourself a little bit more of a financial cushion, and take a slightly less pricey place in the interest of trying to build up some savings on your own. Student loans, obviously, are negotiable. You want to negotiate a rate that you think you can handle, particularly in your first year. But again, leave yourself a little bit of a cushion. Variable costs, you want to be thinking about planning for reasonable spending. Yes, you're entitled to have a personal life here and there. And reasonable savings. You do need to think about trying to do something in having at least a little bit of a cushion of emergency money as well as short, longer-term investment. You can always save something, no matter how modest it may seem at the beginning. You can always save something. You can do it by saving fixed amounts every month and have it saved automatically, automatically deducted from your paycheck, and you won't miss it if you save it first. And there's always something you can invest in, even in this economic environment. You know, CDs, other kinds of, you know, rock-solid investments, as well as all the more worrisome things in the equity markets. I don't need to give you details about IRAs, but you want to be thinking about the fact that over the long term, IRAs can give you an opportunity to start building substantial long-term returns. For example, this chart from T. Rowe Price, you know, which I don't have any investment with, but actually has a very good chart that shows long-term how much even early investments and regular investments can result in really long-term appreciation over time and help you to build a nice, solid nest egg over the long term. Variable costs, you want to be very careful about credit cards, especially in this environment where credit card issuers are doing more and more to tack on new fees and elevate APRs very dramatically. I mean like 28 and 29% if you miss a payment by even a few days. So you need to be watchful about how much credit card debt can mount. There's a neat little FTC, Federal Trade Commission, credit card calculator online that'll show you just how costly you can be if you have a substantial credit card debt and have to try to repay that on a monthly basis. There's also some quick points here on other ways that you can help to save money for yourselves, looking for ways to cut costs when you have a bank relationship with fee-free ATMs, trying to reduce the risk of having any kind of bounce check fees or late fees on credit cards and so on. And I want to finish up quickly by mentioning personal matters. I really do want to stress that this strategy for your first year really needs to embrace not just the professional, not just the financial, although those are clearly linked, but personal matters as well. You really need to plan to have a personal life. You might be thinking, oh, yeah, but you know, I'm going to be really busy. You have to make deliberate efforts to try to maintain some reservoir of personal life for yourself because it would be very, very easy to succumb to temptation and work yourself to death, especially in the first year. Think about it in terms of making commitments to the relationships you have with family, with significant others, with spouses, with children, and making commitments to do something for yourself, even if it's comparatively modest in time, for yourself and your own personal interests. Recognize also that what you do creates expectations. Robert Spagnoletti, who's now the president of the District of Columbia Bar and had a distinguished practice in public service before he went to private practice, recently wrote this. If we are sending emails at 11 p.m., the message to our clients and our families is that the client can have our attention at 11 p.m. Something to think about in terms of what kinds of signals you want to send consistent with being effective, being efficient, working very hard at wherever you're working. Of course, you want to keep your billables up. The reality is that you may not be able to bill the most, but the fact is that you might be the particular associate in a quarter or six-month period who bills the most doesn't guarantee that you're going to be retained when hard decisions have to be made, particularly because clients are very suspicious about billables and, as I mentioned, billables by first-year associates. What is more likely is that if you're billing at a very low level, well below the rest of your class, that might guarantee that in a difficult set of decisions, you're the one who gets laid off. Planning to have a personal life also includes things like making time for physical activity, whatever you think works for you, running, going to the gym, doing something on a regular basis. You're going to need it, not just enjoy it. You're going to need it to relieve stress, because in your first year particularly, you're going to have a lot of stress, much of which is difficult to cope with until you get your sea legs under you and start seeing how you can work effectively within your employer. Make time for sleep. Again, you think I'm joking. I can speak from personal experience. There was a period when I was a second-year associate where, because I had two major matters on international transactions from two different partner groups, my solution during a relatively, thankfully, brief period was to sleep every other day. Literally, to work around the clock, maybe grab a few minutes here or there for a quick catnap and keep working and working and working, trying to serve two masters simultaneously, and then maybe go home every other day to sleep a little bit. Thankfully, after just a few days of that, one of the partners on one of the major matters, in fact, the lead partner, said, "We really appreciate what you're trying to do here, but we don't want you to endanger your health." And in the end, a little bit of readjustment was done. And while I was still working my tail off, I recognized in retrospect that I was actually disserving my employer by thinking I could somehow run myself into the ground, as opposed to working really hard, but at least maintaining a regular sleep schedule so that I'm reasonably fit and fresh every day that I come to work. And last thing you want to be thinking about, looking ahead to your career, looking ahead to your life in the future. I really recommend that you actively pursue at least one outside interest that has nothing to do with the law. It could be anything in the world. If you play guitar in your spare time, in high school and college, make a little bit of time to do that. If you're interested in art history, it takes effort, but make deliberate efforts to do something in that field. Sooner or later, you're going to find that if you devote yourself to nothing but law, law will be everything that consumes your life and your passions. And even in a profession that demands and expects that we all work our best and hardest, perspective and balance and diversity of interest really helps you, I really believe, to become a better lawyer in the long term. In a way, it really is another kind of long-term investment you're making in your life and yourself. I've covered an awful lot of ground in a short span of time. I'm happy to take questions while everybody's here, but in addition, I will make an unsolicited offer. Take down that information, and 3 months, 6 months, 9 months from now, if you have issues that you need to thrash out with somebody and you're not confident about taking it to your employer or some other lawyer whom you know, I'm happy to get your calls or your emails, and I will do the very best I can to give you advice from outside or find people who can help in giving you the advice on a basis it's anonymous, so nobody has to worry about something getting back to your firm or your agency or whatever.